Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. These were the greats: George Washington, who launched the Republic; Abraham Lincoln, who held it together and ended slavery; FDR, who got us through the Great Depression and World War II. Our guest this hour says today, if he were pressed to identify a potentially great leader, he might offer up not a head of state at all, but rather a religious figure, the Pope, Pope Francis I. How do we explain the absence of great leaders on the world stage? How do we explain the absence of a great president in 70 years? Our guest is the author of The End of Greatness, Why America Can't Have and Doesn't Want Another Great President. Our guest is Aaron David Miller, and he's vice president for new initiatives and a distinguished scholar at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. He served for two decades in the Department of State as an advisor to Republican and Democratic secretaries of state. He helped formulate U.S. policy on the Middle East and the Arab-Israeli peace process, author of a number of other books, and he is our guest this hour. We should have a rousing good time. You may disagree with him. Maybe you think there have been great presidents in the last 70 years. Maybe you would disagree that it doesn't behoove us to have a great president now because it's associated with times of risk and emergencies, that those times in history can give us the possibility of a great president, and best that we not have those times. But I want to start, because I like talking about great presidents too, to start with the greats and why they were great. We want to welcome Aaron David Miller to the program. Hi, Aaron David Miller. Thank you so much for being with us.
Pleasure to be here, Kevin.
Well, before we get to there hasn't been anybody really good in 70 years, let us talk about the greats, because it's interesting how so many people would agree, and maybe it's because of these times in history we should talk about, that George Washington and Abraham Lincoln and FDR, universally, historians would say these are the greats.
Yeah, I mean, remember, I talk about three great presidents, undeniably great presidents.
Right.
In 250 years, Washington in the 18th, Lincoln in the 19th, FDR in the 20th. That doesn't mean that there haven't been presidents other than these three who have accomplished great things. But I draw a distinction between undeniable greatness. And we've now gone the longest stretch in our history, if you measure from the end of Washington's tenure to the beginning of Lincoln's, from the end of Lincoln's to the beginning of FDR's, and then from FDR's death in April 1945 to the present. We've now gone the single longest stretch in our history without what I would describe to you as an undeniably great president. And mm-hmm. greatness, that undeniable greatness is basically a mix. If I were to mix a presidential cocktail for greatness, it would be what I call the three C's: mm-hmm. crisis, character, and capacity. You haven't seen that kind of an alignment since FDR. And when I say crisis, which is the door opener, without crisis, there is absolutely no way in our political system you can have greatness in the presidency. When I say crisis, however, I'm not talking about your garden variety crisis.
No.
I'm not talking about I'm not talking about your great recession or 9/11 or the Cuban Missile Crisis. I'm talking about a crisis that is hot, irrepressible, inescapable, and goes on for quite a long period of time. Only that kind of crisis in our political system. And that's the way the founders willfully designed it. It was a political system designed to create a powerful but accountable executive driven by shared and separated powers. The only thing that allows the kind of accretion of power is a crisis that domesticates the political system, creates a measure of cooperation in the political elites, and with the right character and capacity, allows the public to follow. We have not had one of those since the Great Depression and World War II, and frankly, we don't want one back, which is the simple equation that I've concocted. You do not want another undeniably great president, because if you are going to have any chance of one emerging, it will be in response to nation-encumbering crisis,
mm-hmm.
and we don't want one of those. In fact, fortunately, nations are like individuals. They go through formative periods in their development, and if they survive, they survive because they actually have weathered the kinds of foundational crises that our country has. And we were fortunate enough during the times in which we had those crises, to have leaders who are wise enough, pragmatic enough, principled enough to guide us through. So bottom line, we have to stop expecting our presidents to be great because we have a presidential addiction. We're waiting for the one to somehow come and rescue us. And since FDR, there are three or four factors that have emerged, in my judgment, which frankly prevent the one from emerging. And that's why we need to stop expecting our presidents to be great and allow them to be good.
Well, it's interesting when you say you would be hard-pressed to come up with a great world leader, and what you come up with is the current pope. And is that due to a crisis in the Catholic Church, or is that due to a whole host of, you know, illnesses and the rise of fundamentalism all over the world and these extremes of wealth and poverty, so that we have a leader who's addressing all those worldwide concerns? Or does he come to us in, because there are so many Catholics and the church is in trouble?
The offhand reference to the Pope is merely an effort to suggest that in the political world, the so-called greats that used to, the giants of old, the Mandelas, the Sadats, the De Gaulles, the Adenauers, they are gone. And we are now in a post-heroic leadership phase, in large part because of changes in the world. First of all, greatness, by definition, is rare. All right, you could count on your hand, maybe a few more fingers, the number of truly transformative leaders in the 20th century. I mean, it was John Keegan, the military historian, who argued that six men between the years 1920 and 1950 were responsible for most of the death and destruction and devastation and prospects for peace and prosperity for much of the Western world. And three of those leaders, Lenin, Hitler, and Stalin, four actually, if you count Mao Zedong, were not what I would call leaders who were pledged to bringing, you know, justice, peace, and morality into the world. Churchill and FDR, on the other hand, the other two, could be considered clearly both transformative and good. But those leaders are gone. There are 193 nations that sit in the UN. I would defy any of your listeners to identify one who any of them would describe as potentially transformational.
All right, well, we'll ask.
Let alone good. That's why I come to the Pope, because he isn't in the traditional strict sense of the word a political leader. He certainly has enormous influence and power, but he isn't a conventional political leader.
Right. Well, let's go back to some of the greats, because I want to take it a little bit beyond Washington to this whole host of people who were part of our founding fathers. And, you know, we got Washington and Franklin and Madison and Adams and Thomas Paine and all of those people who, thank God, were here when the Republic was starting. But, you know, I realize at this advanced stage in my life that I haven't paid enough attention to George Washington. And you reminded me that I need to pay more attention, because here we have this guy, and you say his achievements were in three areas: setting precedents, strengthening central authority, and reducing the young republic's vulnerability in this dangerous world of European powers, et cetera. It is, when you just stop and think about it, here was a guy who had to convince people that central authority was going to make this run, who was facing rebellion from fellow Americans, who was crafting what the presidency was going to be. I mean, what a huge figure in American history, and he did it well.
Right, and I think the key about Washington is he had no predecessors. And
right,
There were no precedents. There was no U.S. government. There was no...
Right,
I mean,
there was
Washington
nothing, yeah.
Didn't even become the capital until a year after Washington died. You know, he said he walked on untrodden ground, and it was right. It was right. No American has stood at the central nexus of more historic events in the country's history than this guy.
Mm-hmm.
And for 24 years, he was at the center of it all. Even before the Revolution, by age 23, he was the single most important military leader in the state of Virginia.
Amazing.
Tremendous confidence that his colleagues had for him, and as during that hot summer in Philadelphia, that 4-month summer when 55 guys hammered out a document which you know, may not have been perfect, but it's an extraordinary testament to the spirit of compromise and collegiality and sheer wisdom. The U.S. Constitution, I mean, he was the president of the convention, and they were looking at him for 4 months, and when it came time to actually deal with Section 2, Article 2 of the Constitution, what to do about the executive, the reason the presidency came out so well, I think, and they would admit it too, is that they had Washington in mind. And that exemplar, his ascent to power, and even more remarkably, an act that King George III, his former adversary, would comment on, his willful decision after 8 years to give it up and return to Mount Vernon was virtually unknown in the political world of that time. Mm-hmm. No one voluntarily gave up power. And Washington set a precedent, as we know, that would be respected and would govern American politics until one of his undeniably great successors, Franklin Roosevelt, was elected, although he didn't serve them out, to four terms. So Washington, on both ends, the ascent to power, the use of power, and the way he gave up power, really, in some respects, emerged as a truly extraordinary figure, even among the three greats.
Yeah, I think you refer to him as, you call Jefferson the Renaissance president, but the Renaissance man, but you call Washington the Renaissance president.
Yeah, I mean, in the sense that he really, literally was forced to do so many things, and the consequences of everything that he did set a tone, set a precedent. Remember, you were dealing with a political culture that had a tremendous wariness, both of the mob on one hand and the accretion of power on the other. And Washington had to really find that balance and create a framework within which you could actually create cohesion in a young republic. And there were many forces during those years threatening to pull the nation apart, including the Whiskey Rebellion. And it was, again, George Washington who mobilized 6,000, more than 6,000, 13,000 American forces, and for a time rode out at the head of those forces in order to put down this rebellion, which threatened, again, the cohesion and coherence and the integrity of the young republic. And if you add to that the fact that you had foreign powers literally in our backyard, the Brits, the French, right, to a lesser extent the Spanish, the way Washington navigated those very difficult constraints and kept America out of external wars was further testament to his judgment and his wisdom.
You talk about Lincoln and FDR being polarizers and party men. They drove change situated in strongly held partisan views on what they believed was necessary to address the country's ills. How do you do that? How can you be a partisan great and get substantial change?
Yeah, I mean, they were both party men. Lincoln was a Republican, and I think had a lot to do with the creation and the emergence of the Republican Party. Had tremendously intense views, certainly by two or three years into his presidency, about what to do about slavery. And really, in some respects, was functioning in the most partisan environment of all. I mean, we have red and blue states today, right? Think about the fact that Abe Lincoln confronted gray and blue states.
I know, amazing.
He confronted the worst calamity that would befall any nation.
Right.
Civil War, and by my modern estimates, they now believe that there were at least a million deaths and injuries as a consequence of that war. You know, states seceded from the Union. It was the ultimate act of polarization. And yet Lincoln, as a Republican, as a partisan, in defense of trying to redefine the basis and justification for the war, had a drive change. He drove the 13th Amendment. I mean, mm-hmm. Steven Spielberg's movie is a wonderful testament to that, even though it's certainly the poster child, as I argue, for why we cannot have a president like Abraham Lincoln back today. But remember, what made that partisanship in the interests of a broader American national interest possible was calamity, was crisis of an irrepressible nature. And the same with FDR, who assembled the most extraordinary coalition on the Democratic side that would last for 40 years. And he drove change as well, using first the crisis of the Great Depression and then World War II to leave the United States by the time of his death. And the only war, by the way, that ever succeeded in doing this, stronger at home and with more influence abroad. These were partisans of their party's principles, but they drove change and legitimized change in the interests of the nation as a whole. And that is a very instructive lesson for today. Mm-hmm. Transformative change in America, whether it was the 13th Amendment abolishing slavery, whether it was FDR's Social Security bills, whether it was Johnson's three civil rights bills, Medicare, Medicaid, passed with broad bipartisan majorities, which gave those transformative pieces of legislation legitimacy, authority, and over time, a broader measure of popular acquiescence. And that is the challenge, of course, with our modern-day political system. When you have a president, in this case Barack Obama, who felt very strongly about health care but ended up driving it home with a large partisan majority. And that in our political system is somewhat of an aberration when it comes to such momentous change. And that's, in some respects, it's worrisome. It's not that healthcare, by definition, is problematic. I think there are elements of the Affordable Health Care Act that are extremely important. It's just, Jefferson said it better than I ever could. Transformative change can never rest, he argued, on slender majorities. Hmm. That's it's a cautionary tale.
Let's welcome phone calls. Our guest this hour is Aaron David Miller. He's the author of The End of Greatness, Why America Can't Have and Doesn't Want Another Great President. He says the greats were undeniable, George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, and FDR, but for a whole host of reasons, some of which he has outlined, we don't really need undeniably great anymore because it would require a kind of crisis that we wouldn't want to experience. But we can have pretty good, and maybe we haven't had a whole lot of that. Well, we welcome your phone calls. Did I give you the number? You know, you do this so much you forget, so it won't hurt to do it again. The number for you to join this conversation is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we are also on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. So that will be fun to have you join us. And we do want you to join us again tonight at 7 o'clock on Wisconsin Public Radio for the Here and Now Wisconsin Vote Special. It's an interview program anchored by WPR's Glenn Moberg and WPT's Frederica Freiberg, featuring in-depth information from the front-running candidates in the governor's race. That's the Here and Now Wisconsin Vote Candidate Special. It's tonight at 7 on Wisconsin Public Radio. The End of Greatness, Why America Can't Have and Doesn't Want Another Great President. Aaron David Miller is our guest this hour. Aaron is Vice President for New Initiatives and a distinguished scholar at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. And we have phone calls coming in and emails, so let's go right to them. And we're starting with, is it Pevin in Milwaukee?
Yeah, I'm sorry, you're kind of breaking up a bit. My comment is, I think that we may be already in kind of an unrecognized crisis in terms of the growing rise of the plutocracy, and especially considering the possibility of a relatively soon technological singularity. I really feel like the combination of those two factors may completely erode our democracy, or at least any pretense of it. And I would just like to hear a comment about that.
Yeah, thank you. Aaron David?
You know, look, we have what I would call slow bleeds as crises, all right? That doesn't mean they don't threaten the nation, but they're not as relentless, as imminent, and as intense and urgent as the great crises that produced the undeniably great presidents. These slow bleeds may ultimately, including income equality and the weakening of the middle class, may ultimately pose great challenges to the republic. I mean, I think the republic over time will manage to find ways to deal with them, however imperfectly. But they're not the kind of crises that essentially domesticate the political system. And in fact, our crises, I call them the six deadly D's, debt, dependence on hydrocarbons, deficits, dysfunctional politics, decaying infrastructure, disastrous educational system, these tend to polarize and divide. They don't tend to unite. And if you combine that with the fact that we genuinely in this country have fundamental divisions between Democrats and Republicans over many issues, but in the main, the role of government, you see how difficult it is for a president, any president. I don't care how skilled they are as a worker of Congress. And Obama's not the best here, certainly no Lyndon Baines Johnson on this issue. It's very difficult for the president to build the kinds of coalitions that are necessary to deal with these slow bleeds. So I think that the dysfunctional nature of our political system and these slower bleeds really are, in many respects, another constraint and drag on the prospects for presidential greatness. We need coalition builders. We need presidents who are smart, who can build bridges, who aren't polarizers. And in this political system, it's very difficult to produce those.
Isn't it, though, also the task of a leader, of a president, and of a great leader to take an issue? You talk about global warming. Many scientists in the world would say this is a defining issue of our times and something needs to be done, or, you know, we're not going to be around maybe 200 years from now. That's the end of it. Instead of it being a political polarizing decision, isn't it something that a leader, and we're right to expect this from our president, take on these big issues and, I don't know, persuade others — all conversation is the act of persuasion — that this is important so that the American public embraces a solution to it and so that other politicians will embrace a solution?
You know, I think this is part of the problem. We have this cardboard, almost cartoonish view of the president as persuader in chief. That is to say, we elect a president, he, and then one day for sure, she, and with a substantial majority and a mandate. And this president then, by virtue of will, force of authority, great speeches, takes on issue X and produces transformative change, which his or her detractors ultimately are simply forced to acquiesce in. That's really not the way change happens. And presidents, as much as it is a job of a president to educate, without the right circumstances, and certainly without the right number of votes in Congress, if you need congressional sanction to pass these kinds of legislation, particularly on climate change, there's a limited amount you can do through executive action, and this president is doing that through executive authority and executive orders. But you cannot take on an issue like climate change and somehow seek to impose it. If you don't have the crisis that convinces the vast majority of the public or the political elites that this issue poses an imminent, urgent, relentless challenge, then what happens is it doesn't get done. I mean, take gun control. A normal human being might have been persuaded in the wake of the terrible, terrible tragedy at Newtown that finally a moment had arisen when, in fact, something could get done. You had a crisis. You had a national moment. But guess what? A combination of Republican opposition and enough Democrats who wouldn't support the president, essentially turned Newtown, tragically, in my judgment, into basically business as usual. So, no, the president can persuade if the words are rooted in a reality that people feel and in enough political power that he can persuade legislators and persuade Washington that something needs to be done. And frankly, on most issues, I mean, let's see what happens. Maybe either if the Republicans win the Senate and control Congress, studies have shown that divided government, when one party controls the legislature and the other controls the presidency, the White House, is not necessarily an RX, a prescription for impasse. Things get done under those circumstances. Let's see if in the next 2 years, less than 1,000 days that remains in the Obama presidency, if some major significant piece of legislation could get done. I have my doubts.
Let's go to Dave in Fond du Lac next. Hi, Dave.
Hi, Kathleen. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
And I just wanted to respond to your guest Aaron's challenge here to nominate somebody who you would consider to be a great leader nowadays. And I know we're talking about America, but I would have to throw Putin into that mix. I mean, love him or hate him, he has done some extremely transformative things with his different partnerships with China and brokering the new financial deal, the new nuclear fission deal, overseeing the largest joint military operations in history. He's changing geographical landscape. Like I said, love him or hate him, he's got to be thrown into that conversation. And beyond all that, lastly, beyond being just a leader for the Russian people, I think he's a leader for all of the other countries in the world who are trying to stand up in the face of EU and the United States economic imperialism and actually having some backbone to it. That's just my comment, and I'll take the rest of what you have to say off the air.
All right, Dave. Thanks for the call.
I mean, Putin is a strong leader driven by the forces of history and geography, and he's probably one of the strongest Russian leaders. But would I argue that Vladimir Putin is transformational? I mean, he's presiding over the former Soviet Union, which is inherently weakening a society that is reducing opportunities for the middle class, in which intelligence organizations and extremely wealthy individuals dominate Russian society, enormous corruption. He aggrandized and invaded Crimea, is pursuing separatist ambitions in eastern Ukraine. I see Putin as a strong leader like President Erdogan of Turkey, adept at keeping his position. But I'm not sure I would argue that, certainly on the positive side, that Vladimir Putin is a transformative, let alone a great or good leader who's going to leave a legacy that will alter a nation in a positive manner, let alone a neighborhood. I think Putin is perceived to be, in some respects, extremely dictatorial by his own people, proud Russian nationalists as he is and they may be, and certainly in Eastern and Western Europe as a significant factor to be dealt with, but not necessarily as a positive force for transformative change.
Aaron David Miller is our guest. He's the author of The End of Greatness, Why America Can't Have and Doesn't Want Another Great President. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Let's talk about some presidents over the past 70 years since FDR who've been pretty good.
I mean, I argue, think this book identifies 11 presidents, 3 undeniably great, 5 I call the close but no cigar presidents. Those are presidents, and I'll name them now, Jefferson, Jackson, Teddy Roosevelt, Woodrow Wilson, and Harry Truman, whose crises were not as large, whose flaws and imperfections were much greater than the undeniable greats, but presidents who in many respects dominated their age, and were responsible for each in their own way great acts in the presidency, and then 3 additional presidents to round out the 11. Now remember, we've had 44 presidents, 43 different presidents, because Grover Cleveland was president twice in non-consecutive terms. So I'm arguing that the last three, rounding out the group of 11, have what I consider to be traces of greatness, real or perceived. And those would be Jack Kennedy, 1,037 days, not long enough, of course, to be judged a great president, but for several reasons, it, certainly in the public's mind, he rates higher in the public opinion polls. The 50th anniversary of the assassination was a classic example of this,
right,
of the president you'd want back. He was our idealized conception,
mm-hmm,
aspirational, pragmatic, a war hero, beautiful wife, Camelot, and the assassination, tragically but paradoxically, would freeze him forever. In his moment, he would remain the what might have been president. Young, handsome. I just listened to his "I am a Berliner" speech on YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
When you listen to that speech and you look at Kennedy, thick hair, you know, brushed back in the cold Berlin wind, and you see his vitality and his aspirations, it's really extraordinary. In 50 years since the Ask Not inaugural, there has not been an inaugural address that was as good as, let alone better, than that speech. So Kennedy is one. His handling of the Cuban Missile Crisis, I think, frankly, was put him in some respects, even though he helped to create the crisis through the Bay of Pigs, he diffused it, and it was the only moment in the Cold War where the United States and the former Soviet Union literally squared off with the prospects of a nuclear exchange being real.
Mm-hmm.
LBJ, he could not be an undeniably great president because of Vietnam. But Medicare and Medicaid, three civil rights bills, particularly the 1964 bill, which passed with huge, huge bipartisan majorities, made him legislatively a transformative president. And finally, Ronald Reagan, who, in many respects, fascinating figure, about whom both Clinton and Obama, two Democrats that didn't share his views on just about everything, both argued that he altered the trajectory of the country. Reagan's real contribution, it seemed to me, he didn't bring about the fall of the Soviet Union. He didn't create Gorbachev. But his pragmatism and Reagan's utopianism in wanting to abolish all nuclear weapons, he mainstreamed that idea. He took an idea that nobody believed in, and he mainstreamed it, got Gorbachev to cooperate, and his great presidential act was offering Gorbachev the pragmatic hand, which resulted in the end of the Cold War and a situation in which the dangers of a nuclear exchange between the United States and the former Soviet Union have now been reduced.
Hmm.
Those three.
How about Harry Truman?
Yeah, I mean, I put Truman in the close but no cigar category. He's he's part of the original five. Three undeniably greats, five what I call close but no cigar presidents, and three who had traces of greatness. Truman, the most underestimated man in the presidency, was called the Missouri Compromise when FDR chose him as vice president in 1944. FDR never talked to him. He ignored him. He inherited a terrible, terrible situation in the wake of FDR's death from a cerebral hemorrhage in Warm Springs, Georgia, in April of 1945. And Truman exceeded expectations in many respects. NATO, the Berlin airlift, desegregation of the armed forces, a decision-maker, plain-spoken, tough, got us into Korea, which is one of the asterisks that separates him from the greats, and chose not, as we know, to seek the presidency again in 1952. But again, a man who was considered to be consequential and created a frame of reference. I guess my point, Kathleen, is that we've created a frame of greatness which has so raised expectations for our presidents in an implausible, impossible job that in many respects we've priced their performance out of the market as a consequence of our own desires that our presidents be a kind of cross between Harrison Ford and Air Force One and Superman.
Right.
And the reality is, you know, The West Wing may have been one of the most entertaining HBO series, but it was in many respects a fictional presidency. But we take our cues from our own sort of Hollywood conceptions of what we think the president should be. Again, I'll say, stop expecting these people to be great. Allow them to be good, and good in three senses. Number one, good in the sense that they're effective and competent. They know what they're doing. Good in the sense that they're morally grounded, and they remain within the law. You know, the word I appears in our Constitution only twice. Now, why would a personal pronoun appear in the Constitution of the United States? It's because the founders put the inaugural oath, the president's inaugural oath, they embedded it in the document. And their point was to demonstrate that the president isn't the source of authority. It's not the individual. It's not even the office. It's the document driven by the people.
Mm-hmm.
And you must remain within the confines of the law. And finally, good in the sense that you are emotionally intelligent. You know who you are. You're comfortable in your mm-hmm. own skin. You're not driven by demons and aspirations that you cannot possibly achieve and that push you to do things that are not good for the benefit of the republic. So, good, but not great.
Let's go to Jessica in Fort McCoy. Hi, Jessica.
Hi. Thank you for taking my question.
Sure.
There are a couple of things I noticed in the description of your project that were perhaps a little troubling to me. And the first is the ways in which I think you're greatness, and I think it has a potential to really eclipse in very problematic ways some of the really terrible things that these presidents did during their administrations and during their tenure. And second of all, I'm thinking that you're also privileging the nation state in a way that is deeply troubling, and I'm wondering if your colleagues have ever questioned you about the narrative that you're weaving, and if they haven't, I mean, you can respond to me, but I'm just wondering, you know, how you would sort of respond to those kinds of critiques.
Well, the book points out the imperfections of the greats. I mean, and again, these were not, even the undeniables were not perfect men. I mean, there's no question about that. I mean, but again, given the realities of the challenges that they faced, they got most of the big decisions right. And we're talking here big decisions. I mean, you know, 12 out of our first 18 presidents were slave owners, including George Washington. You know, at a time when, in fact, there were many in the early years of the Republic who came out forcefully against slavery. And George Washington may have been a relatively benign slave owner, but he still pursued fugitive slaves. He used corporal punishment against them. So no, these were, look, the imperfections, as we are all imperfect, the imperfections of these individuals were clear. But again, you know, nobody gets 100% in life, and given the challenge that they faced, they were quite remarkable. FDR, again, you know, who imprisoned Issei and Nisi, Japanese Americans, in probably one of the worst acts of his presidency, or Andrew Jackson and the Trail of Tears and his policies toward Native Americans. Yeah, all of these things. Jefferson was a slave owner, too, and may have had fathered a child or two with Sally Hemings. These were highly imperfect men, no question. But they also were extraordinary leaders confronting extraordinary challenges.
Jessica, what were the imperfections that would keep you from calling any of the leaders great? They were such great grievances that they'd have to be off the list.
Pardon?
What imperfections are particularly troubling to you?
Well, he's pointed out a lot of them. Slaveholding,
right.
And even Abraham Lincoln, you know, he came to the anti-slavery debate relatively late and for, you know, very political reasons. And so by many accounts, I mean, he could be classified as a white supremacist. FDR, especially with the Japanese internment, And then I think you mentioned Harry Truman, but then you've got the deliberate targeting of civilians with the firebombing of Japan and then the dropping of the atomic bomb. I think the narrative that might be privileged in your project is one that is going to say, well, you know, they weren't perfect. And I feel like that is really dismissive and potentially dangerous.
I fundamentally disagree. I guess I come from a different place. You know, I worked for the Department of State, serving the interests of the United States for 25 years. And I realized in government, as with most aspects of the human enterprise, including friendship, marriage, business proposition, there is no gold standard. There's no perfection. The United States is an extraordinary country. It's also committed tremendous transgressions, both at home and abroad. But what kind of world can you live in which there is the kind of perfection that you're trying to describe? I mean, there is no such world. We cannot make the perfect the enemy of the good. And as for the nation state, I mean, it remains hundreds of years into the human enterprise a resilient form of government. I wouldn't know, frankly, what the alternative would be. I'm glad we live in a country called the United States of America with all of its imperfections, and there are many.
Let's pause for a moment. Thank you, Jessica, very much for your call, for you to join our conversation. We're speaking this hour with the author of The End of Greatness, Why America Can't Have and Doesn't Want Another Great President. Aaron David Miller is our guest. Aaron is vice president for new initiatives and a distinguished scholar at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. He was an advisor for 24 years, he just said, to Republican and Democratic secretaries of state. More phone calls momentarily. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, our phone number, 800-486-8655. Let's go to messages from Facebook and emails. Brad writes this: are we forgetting that FDR and had a Democratic majority in Congress to work with? That's huge, he says. It's hard to be transformative without that.
I mean, I think that's right. Barack Obama had a Democratic majority in the House and filibuster Senate, which is why he got the Affordable Health Care Act passed. The issue is not just the Democratic majority, though. In moments of transformative change, you really do need and should aspire to, if you can, the kind of bipartisan participation that lends transformative legislation authority and legitimacy. And at during the moments of transformative change in this country, the key ones, there has been, to a large degree, that kind of bipartisanship. So I think that's important. That's important to keep in mind. But the Facebooker is 100% right. I mean, in 1966, Johnson didn't have the votes, and he couldn't. Many of his Great Society programs suffered as a consequence.
Sarah in Zion, Illinois. Hi. Whoa. Hello.
Hi. Okay.
Yeah.
One of your criteria of a great president was effectiveness, and yet you included the Pope as a great leader. And although I agree that he's saying really important things, he's not effective. He's not really changing anybody's policy. And so by that measure, I would like to say that I think Barack Obama needs to, even though I agree that he's constrained by you know, what Congress won't do, he, not just as a president, but just as a person, he has a responsibility to speak out more strongly. And because we're facing the crisis of global warming, he has a responsibility to speak out more strongly than he has about the dangers of it. And there is so much more he could do with his executive power. I mean, he passed those coal standards, but they're very, very mild. And I think the reason he doesn't do more is because he doesn't want to basically piss off the petroleum industry and the status quo in the Democratic Party, and he doesn't want to risk Democrats losing elections in the future. But I think in the long term, that's a very irresponsible strategy.
I mean, I think the problem with presidential rhetoric is the more you use it, the more you're obligated to deliver on it. And then the gap between your words and your deeds becomes so large that what remains of presidential credibility falls in the middle. the middle, never to recover. I mean, again, the notion of the president as persuader-in-chief makes sense if, in fact, you have circumstances rooted in reality which give the president's rhetoric meaning. But if you have a wall of political opposition and the country is not seized with, in this case, your particular issue, climate change, much more concerned with unemployment, disposable income, wage disparity, then the words become empty, and the president suffers as a consequence. This guy's in the last 1,000 days of his presidency. His public approval ratings are dramatically low. His own party is running away from him in states like Virginia and North Carolina. I mean, you saw what happened in Kentucky. Candidate for Senate won't even admit that she voted for it. I think that you have a situation here where even though 62% of those polled, according to an ABC Washington Post poll, indicated that their votes in November, 62% will not be based on anything that having to do with Barack Obama, still leaves a lot of unhappy people. And I'm not sure the way to make them happier is to talk tougher without the capacity to do anything about it.
Thanks, Sarah.
I think he's played out his string on this one.
Brian in Fond du Lac. Hi.
Hey, how you doing?
All right, Brian.
I have two questions. First of all, what was your assessment of Dwight Eisenhower? And secondly, you mentioned notable world leaders earlier, and you didn't include Winston Churchill. And I want to know why. Okay, thanks. I'll take my answer.
All right,
here.
Brian. Thanks.
Sure, Brian. I did include Winston Churchill in the six leaders that John Keegan identified as those who were responsible for most of the death, destruction, devastation. Churchill and Roosevelt's case, prospects of peace, prosperity, and salvation of much of the Western world. You know, Eisenhower is an interesting candidate. Unparalleled peace and prosperity during 8 years. Of his presidency. I would argue a man whose contribution in large part was made much more dramatically in many respects before he got to the White House. But a guy whose popularity was extraordinary, a guy who kept the United States out of Vietnam, who ended the Korean War. I mean, I think Ike's stock has risen. The reason I didn't put him on the list is because I'm not sure you could identify one single initiative that would fall into my definition of greatness, which I don't think I've identified, to meet a nation-encumbering crisis, to extract out of that crisis some piece of transformative legislation that alters the way we think about ourselves, the way we govern ourselves, and then finally, to be appreciated by Democrats and Republicans and independents alike as a truly national figure. Ike has a problem with a couple of those, but a consequential president, competent, absolutely.
One more call. Jim in Chippewa Falls. Hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I guess I have two questions. One is, it seems like possibly happenstance that during these crises, we had greatness in the presidency, and perhaps it's that, their decisions were monumental because of the context in which those decisions were made. And my second observation is that it seems like we're in a crisis now, a climate crisis, a crisis of economic inequality, a crisis of political partisanship and gridlock. And if we need a transformative change that's come from a crisis, then I guess we need another crisis.
Thank you, Jim, very much for your call. There's still a look for that greatness from the public. We're out of time. I want to thank you, Aaron David Miller, so much for being with us. Interesting conversation.
I really enjoyed it. And thanks for all your callers.
Yeah, they're great, aren't they? Thanks, Aaron. Aaron David Miller, the book is The End of Greatness, Why America Can't Have and Doesn't Want Another Great President. Jim, thanks for your call. It's a good place to end the show and contemplate your question. And Aaron is Vice President for New Initiatives, a distinguished scholar at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Just a reminder for those of you who are following politics, and that's everybody in this audience, tomorrow night at 7, Wisconsin Public Radio, the second of two gubernatorial debates sponsored by the Wisconsin Broadcasters Association. Make sure that you listen to that. And tonight at 7, Here and Now, Wisconsin Vote Candidates Special, WPR's Glenn Moberg and WPT's Federica Freiberg. In-depth information from front-running candidates in the governor's race. Thanks to Scotty Myers for doing on-air production and KP Whaley.